Why not, Hal? Because actually the point he makes is worth having on tape. So I'm reviewing Yair Zakovich's Jacob, which is in the Yale University Press series of Jewish Lives, which is the same series that I'm writing King David for. So when they sent me the book, I said, look, you know, I'd be happy to review it, but you should know that I'm writing in the same thing. And he basically said, you know, I'll trust that you will be honest about it. And if you hate it and therefore don't want to review it, so you'll say, you know, I don't want to sabotage somebody. And he said, but I'm pretty confident. And Zakovich is a well-known biblical scholar, and it was unlikely that it was going to be. Well, it's wonderful. It's a really wonderful book. But he reads the Torah, I mean, as a modern critical scholar does, which is as a human document, and he sees different layers and different voices in it. And he's pretty persuaded, and he makes a pretty good case, that the actual rape of Dina was added later. That what happened was this guy from Shechem fell in love with Dina, and the Israelites all went out and slaughtered them. And then, seeing how the story looks not so good for the Israelites, so they threw it a later, he believes a later editor, I mean, there's no way of proving, but a later editor put that in, which is not implausible, knowing what we now know, probably not what you thought when you came into the class, but knowing what we now know, it's not implausible because it was a savage world, and people do foolish things, like Barry Bonds. Okay, I don't know where that came from. Those of you who are not sports fans would not. Barry Bonds was one of the greatest players of baseball and then decided to pump himself up on steroids and became the premier home run hitter of all time, but his body changed absurdly in a few years, and they just rejected him for the Hall of Fame.
Did you see today's New York Times? Big blank. They have big blank.
Oh, I didn't see the sports.
Pure white.
I'm one of the.
As to who got into the Hall of Fame.
Really? I'm one of the three or four men in America who, when they get the newspaper, I get the LA and the New York Times, I throw out the business and sports sections and read the rest of the paper. That's why I ended up being a rabbi. It's really true. I take like a quick look at the back of the business section because that's where the New York Times puts the obituaries.
Yes.
So I look at the back of the business section to see who the obituaries are. And then I don't look at the sports section unless the Eagles are playing. And this year it wasn't worth looking even if they were. And then I throw out the rest of the, and I read the editorials in the arts because that's what, go figure. I don't know. God knew what he was doing when he gave me a girl. That's all I can say. Said, this guy needs a daughter. Forget the, when I was young, I was a sports fanatic. And then at a certain point, I don't know. I outgrew me or I outgrew it. And then I had a daughter and I tried to get her interested in football. And when that didn't succeed, I said, okay, forget it. At the end of the, I made her watch a game. And then at the end of it, I said, now, wasn't that? And she goes, Daddy, I watched it for you. And I said, that's really nice. And you never have to do that again. Once is, you know. Okay. So let's go to the text. I think we finished at the end of 26. Is that right? We didn't do 27 yet. But here too, you will see David's the ambiguity of David's story, and by that I mean what it is exactly that he is up to, and how hard it is to decide. David said to himself, someday I shall certainly perish at the hands of Saul. The best thing for me is to flee to the land of the Philistines. Saul will then give up hunting me throughout the territory of Israel, and I'll escape him. I think we did do this, but let's. So David and 600 men went and crossed to King Achish, son of Maoch of Gath. David and his men stayed with Achish in Gath, and each man with his family, David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Nabal the Carmelite. Remember, not Michal, Saul's daughter, who he has left behind. And when Saul was told that David had fled to God, he didn't pursue him anymore. It was the only safe place was in the enemy's territory, just like, I mean, this is not a great analogy, but just like you remember the spies from England, the Kim Philbys, when they went to Russia, they stayed there and they lived there their whole lives because there was no way England could get them once they were in Russia and they were, you know, feted and given, you know, they were treated as heroes, kind of like Depardieu. Jerk. Really, what a jerk. At least French, because the taxes are too high. Okay. Sorry. 75% is excessive, but for, to be a multi-gazillion dollar actor and leave for Russia because of it is also a little excessive. David said to Achish, it's almost like the Facebook guy who left the United States because the taxes were too high. I don't remember which one was it. There was a guy from Facebook, I think the Jewish one, who left the United States because we only made him billions of dollars, but then wanted a percentage of it. David said to Achish, if you please, let a place be granted for me in one of the country towns where I can live. By the way, Philistine taxes were low. Why should your servant remain with you in the royal city? At that time, Achish granted him Ziklag. This is how Ziklag came to belong to the kings of Judah, as is still the case, which is a remarkable little piece of history. And remember, when it says, as is still the case, the kings of Judah, you know that this was written long after David died, because the kings of Judah are part of the line of the kings of Judah. David was the first king of Judah. So you can't say, as is still the case, unless it's far after, and this is one of those deposits in the text that lets you know that the text is not written contemporaneous with David's life. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's almost like saying, and Washington conquered the city of Washington, and it still belongs to American presidents, as is still the case, right? Which you wouldn't get until at least a few presidents after Washington. The length of time that David lived in Philistine territory was a year and 4 months. David and his men went and raided the Geshurites, the Gizrites, the Amalekites, who were inhabitants of the region of Elam, all the way to Shur and the land of Egypt. When David attacked a region, and we spoke about this, he'd leave no man or woman alive, because otherwise they would go back to the Philistines and say, David killed us, whereas David is claiming that he's raiding the Israelites, right? He'd take flocks, herds, asses, camels, and clothing, none of which can speak. When he returned and came to Achish, Achish would ask, where did you raid today? David would reply, the same thing you say to your kids, they come home. Where'd you raid today? The Negev of Judah, the Negev of the Rachmielites, or the Negev of Canaanites, David would leave no man or woman alive to be brought to Gath, for he thought they might tell about us, David did this. Such was his practice as long as he stayed in the territory of the Philistines. Achish trusted David. He thought he's aroused the wrath of his own people Israel, and so he will be my vassal forever. Obviously, we don't know if this is... it seems improbable that he went and killed all these people and nobody ever heard anything about it. Nobody noticed that these groups were gone. The skeptical read of this is that David, in fact, raided the Israelites too, which is something that we saw, remember, with Abigail's husband, Nabal, that he raided the Israelites too, and that's why Achish trusted him. But the chronicler of the story doesn't want to say that about David, king of Judah and Israel. So he doesn't. But there's, as I say, this is speculation, and it's reading against the text, but sometimes that's what you need to do. There's a concept in modern literature called the unreliable narrator. The most famous example of this in literature is a magnificent novel, which if you've never read and you like such things, is really worth reading, Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier. It begins with an amazing line. It says, "This is the saddest story I have ever heard." And it's a really remarkable novel, but the point is that as you go along, you realize that what the narrator is saying to you is not actually what's happening. But the narrator isn't entirely aware of it, and you become aware of it as a reader. I don't want to give you more details than that, but you become aware of it as a reader. Even though the narrator is saying one thing, you learn to read against the narration as the book goes along. So you know more, weirdly, than the narrator of the story. But that idea that what the narrator is saying to you is not actually what's happening, that happens in a lot of stories. And we do it, in fact, every day. When our kids tell us stories, we hear things that they don't know they're saying, right? And the teacher got angry because someone said this. And you understand the teacher in a way that the child doesn't. You get more out of the story than they do because you're reading it against the narration. So a lot of biblical scholars do that with the Bible. That is, we know that the author of the Bible wants us to think that David is killing only non-Israelite groups, but maybe that's not true. The problem is, of course, you can't know, because the only information we have about it is the text itself. At that time, the Philistines mustered their forces for war to take the field against Israel. Achish said to David, You know, of course, that you and your men must march out with my forces. Now push has come to shove, right? We're going to war against Israel and you have to march with us. David answered Achish, and of course the rabbis loved this answer. You surely know what your servant will do. So he doesn't say, of course I will. He says, look, you know me. Achish replied to David, I will appoint you my bodyguard for life. So once again, this is, how edgy do we want the Torah class to get? This reminds me of something that I actually saw this morning. Let me put it this way. Let me start with the statement and then I'll give you the example. Gifted with enough charm, it's remarkable what you can get away with and how much people can trust you. And that's clearly David's gift, yes. Right? David, as Harold Bloom, I told you, said, David gets everyone to love him, even God, right? And I say this because just this morning I saw, I don't even know what organization did it, but somebody named Bill Clinton Father of the Year, which is a pretty interesting, it was on the Drudge Report. So, unimpeachable source. Well, he linked to something. Given enough charm, you can really, it's remarkable how much you can succeed even in persuading people against their interest, because this is clearly against Achish's interest, like a con man, right? It's just, and skills that you don't credit. In fact, happened, there was an article that I only read a part of, because it was long and life is short, in The New Yorker about the greatest pickpocket in the world. And it's an amazing article, right? At least the beginning of it was amazing, but then I sort of, my curiosity flagged. But part of what he does when he's actually, if he's not just coming up behind you, and he now does this for show, he doesn't do it, not now, I don't think he ever did it for illegally, but part of it is the way that he talks to you while he's pickpocketing you. So it's not just that he comes up behind you and takes your wallet and you don't know that he was there, although he can do that too, but it's partly his charm and his manner that leads you not to pay attention to the fact that your watch is suddenly in his hand. And so the ability of human beings, especially certain human beings, certain gifted human beings like David, to persuade other people against their interest that they're, you know, trustworthy and good and so on is astonishing. Now Samuel had died, and all Israel made lament for him, and he was buried in his own town of Ramah. And Saul had forbidden recourse to ghosts and familiar spirits in the land. Now that's important, right? And that's a religious, and it will become important later in the story, that is, there's no source of divination other than God. You can ask God what's going to happen in the future, but you can't go to soothsayers, fortune tellers, all those things that have had a long history, as you know, in human chronicles and still flourish. The Philistines mustered and they marched to Shunem and encamped. And Saul gathered all Israel and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the Philistine force, his heart trembled with fear. And Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord didn't answer him, either by dreams or by Urim, or by the prophets. So Urim are the breastplate of the priests, are called the Urim v'Tumim. It's some kind of almost like dice, although not exactly, that you throw, and what it shows, the way it comes up, lets you know the future. Okay, so it's binary. That is, it's yes or no. So you ask it a question, it has to be a yes or no question, and it like the magic eight ball, it will tell you what the answer is. A little different, but not in theory. I'm just talking at a meta level. So Saul said to his courtiers, find me a woman who consults ghosts so I can go and inquire through her. And his courtiers told him there was a woman in Endor who consulted ghosts. Now this is a famous and much, much discussed passage, but it's really, anyway, Saul disguised himself. He put on different clothes and set out with two men. Okay. There's a linguistic relationship between clothes and deception in Hebrew. Me'il and me'ilah, which is Me'il is a coat and deception. Me'ila is deception. Beged is a frock. Bogade is a traitor. So the idea that clothes deceive is like rooted in the very structure of the Hebrew language. So they came to the woman by night and said, please divine for me by a ghost. Bring up for me the one I shall name to you. But the woman answered him, you know what Saul has done, how he's banned the use of ghosts and familiar spirits in the land. Why are you laying a trap for me to get me killed? So now, one of the many questions about this story is, does she recognize Saul? Okay, you'll see later on that she does come to recognize him, but does she already? Because if this is her living, maybe she does it, but or maybe she says this to everyone, you know, I just want to find out if you're a cop before I take your money. I mean, that's essentially, it's not so different. That is, she provides an illicit service according to Saul's decree, so she wants to make sure that whoever this is not going to get her. Saul swore to her by the Lord, as the Lord lives, you won't get in trouble over this. Now, who could make that assurance to her other than Saul that you won't get in trouble over this? So it may be. At that, the woman asked, whom shall I bring up for you? He answered, bring up Samuel for me. Then the woman recognized Samuel. Now, as you see from the note here, some manuscripts read, then the woman recognized Saul. And it could easily be that this is a transcription error. Don't forget the Torah was written and Shmuel was written over and over and over and over and over again. And at some point, some careless scribe could have written Samuel instead of Saul. But the text says she recognized Samuel. Okay? and shrieked loudly and said to Saul, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. Now, the other possibility is that she doesn't want to say she recognizes Saul until the deed is done and he's implicated too. So once she's called Samuel up from the underworld, then it's okay to say, why have you deceived me, Saul? Because he did it. So he can't, you know, he can't indict her. The king answered, don't be afraid. What do you see? And the woman said to Saul, I see a divine being coming up from the earth. What does he look like? He asked her. It's an old man coming up. Well, that's a pretty good bet, right? Because if she says, I want Samuel, right? And we know that Samuel just died and he's been the high priest in Israel for a very long time. She may never have seen Samuel, but an old man is, you know. She said, and he's wrapped in a robe, which again, you know. Then Saul knew it was Samuel. He bowed low in homage with his face to the ground. Samuel said to Saul, now remember, when it says Samuel said to Saul, that Samuel speaks through the medium. So one of the questions, and it was Bravanel, and I can't remember who else. Oh, boy. But I will remember at some point when I go back over this. But there are, I think it was Ralbag, who's Gersonides, who was a rationalist, and Bravanel argue about whether, in fact, Samuel was called up from the underworld, or whether this was an elaborate deception played on Saul by this woman. And it's a really, and these are two medievals, right? So one of them just does not want to accept the idea that you really call up people from the underworld, and the other one says, you know, it says she called him up from the underworld. What's the matter with you? So the question is, can you make it plausible, and we'll talk about it in a minute, that in fact, so far, everything she has said is plausible. Right, that she was making this up. Oh, I see an old man. And that she recognizes him, you know, at some point in the proceedings. Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me and brought me up? By the way, this is also one of the very, very rare instances where the Torah talks about or hints at or says there is some kind of afterlife. Because remember, Samuel's dead. And that's another issue. And Saul answered, I'm in great trouble. The Philistines are attacking me, and God has turned away from me. He no longer answers me, either by prophets or in dreams. So I've called you to tell me what I am to do. The silence of God in the face of Saul's pleas is the final and saddest blow, right? Because when God turns away from him, the way that God turns away from you is not just by making your life miserable, but by not responding. And even in Job, if you remember the book of Job, even though terrible things happened to Job, the redemption in some sense is that at the end, God responds. God speaks to Job. And that gives Job some comfort despite all the terrible trials that he's endured. At least the heavens aren't silent. Samuel said, "Why do you ask me, seeing that the Lord has turned away from you and has become your adversary?" The Lord has done for himself as he foretold through me. The Lord has torn the kingship out of your hands and given it to your fellow, to David. Now, again, remember, this happened some time ago, that Samuel and Saul were talking, and Saul turned away, and it said, and he tore his robe. And we didn't know whether it was Samuel or Saul, but it seemed like it was Samuel who tore the robe. It's not improbable that this story was known all through Israel. It's the kind of story that would probably move very fast through the ranks of Israel. Did you hear that Samuel tore Saul's robe and told him that the kingship was over? So the witch of Endor, which is how she's known in the literature, she could have actually, she could have known the story. Very Macbethy, by the way, isn't it? For those of you who, right, all we're missing is a cauldron. Because you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his wrath upon the Amalekites, remember, he didn't kill the king, and therefore God was upset. This is why the Lord has done this to you today. Further, the Lord will deliver the Israelites who are with you into the hands of the Philistines tomorrow. Your sons and you will be with me. And the Lord will also deliver the Israelite forces into the hands of the Philistines. Now, here's the crux of the question. Is there, bless you, a plausible, I mean, the crux, a crux of a question. Is it plausible that she would say to Saul and predict that the Israelites were going to lose the war and he and his kids were going to die? I think it was Abravanel, but I'm not sure. I have to go back and check that. It was years ago that I studied it, and I have it on my pile to go back over, but I haven't. Who says, look, if Saul comes in haggard with a few people, and the Israelites are mustering this great force, and especially, I'll say, although he would never say, especially if there are rumors that David is with them, with the Philistines, right? And there could be those rumors flying all through Israel, as far as we know. Then is it improbable that she would say to Saul what she believes is actually going to happen, especially because everybody now in Israel is probably choosing up sides. And if she's going to choose up sides with David, she wants it known that she, you know, didn't tell Saul, no, you will go and win, and so on and so forth. So it is possible that, in fact, this would be what she would say to the king. But she also feels compassion for him, which is kind of a beautiful thing, as you'll see. At once, Saul flung himself prone on the ground, terrified by Samuel's words. Beside, there was no strength in him because he hadn't eaten anything all day and all night. That's why I said he came in looking haggard. I mean, you've got to imagine that a terrified man who hasn't eaten is not going to present the kind of picture of somebody you think is going to win in battle against the Philistines tomorrow. The woman went up to Saul, and seeing how greatly disturbed he was, she said to him, "Your handmaid listened to you. I took my life in my hands and heeded the request you made of me. So now you listen to me. Let me set before you a bit of food. Eat, and then you'll have the strength to go on your way." He refused, saying, "I will not eat." But when his courtiers as well as the woman urged him, he listened to them. He got up from the ground, sat on the bed. The woman had a stall-fed calf in the house. It's like free-range chicken. She hastily slaughtered it and took flour and kneaded it and baked some unleavened cakes. She set this before Saul and his courtiers, and they ate. Then they rose and left the same night. So, as you can, this is very out of sync with the rest, for that matter, with the rest of the Torah. There isn't another instance of somebody being called up from the underworld. And the underworld is a not, it's called Sheol. I mean, there are other names for it too, but Sheol is the most common. It's not at all clear what the underworld is. And it seems as though Samuel is somehow equivalent to sleeping when he says, you know, "Why did you disturb me?" It doesn't sound like, it's not a picture of Samuel being plucked from heaven. It's a very different and more amorphous and darker thing, this idea of Sheol, which is the idea that seems to reign in the Hebrew Bible. And for the most part, it's more about how you go to Sheol than what things are like in Sheol. So, I mean, you send people's gray hair in grief down to Sheol. That's a threat. So in as much as you get any picture of the afterlife in anywhere in the Tanakh, this is it. But it doesn't tell you very much. Okay, questions, comments on this chapter? Yeah.
Is it possible this is just a dream? He's having a bad dream, he's hallucinating, and he told this to someone and they wrote it down?
Is it possible that he's just having a bad dream and hallucinating and he wrote this down? Kind of like a season in Dallas, right? For those of you who remember, or are old enough to remember that. Right, exactly, yeah. It's possible. I mean, there's no indication, obviously, in the text of that. But yeah, you do wonder who knows about this entire episode. The only plausible source is either the woman herself or one of his courtiers that survives. Could Saul have told somebody the next day? I suppose so. And could it have been a dream? Yeah, although, as I say, there is no indication here. Yeah.
Is it possible there was influence one way or the other from, say, the scene in the Odyssey where Odysseus goes down to the underworld?
Well, rather than assuming, I mean, I think, first of all, that was probably written after the Odyssey. Well, it depends when Homer wrote. If Homer wrote in the 8th century BCE, which is what most scholars sort of assume, that could have been written, actually, it could have even been written before, although there's nothing in the Torah that shows any knowledge of Greek life or myth. So what I would say instead is that journeys to the underworld are all across mythological, I mean, I think they're more, Jung would say it's just the way human imaginations work. You know, they're sort of archetypes, the underworld. And so you get underworld myths and all. But the thing is, we don't get any description here of what the underworld is like. We just get Samuel plucked up from it and then he goes back down. The only thing we know about the underworld is you wear robes there. That's basically all we know. So I don't know. I don't think that there's any particular influence, but who knows? It's amazing how much the rabbis could live, and the Torah, for example, could live beside Greek culture, and really until later stages of Christianity, that is the Gospel of John, really, you don't get any overt, I mean, in all of the Talmud, which uses Greek terms, so it knows from Greek, it doesn't have any philosophical terms at all. Greek philosophy made no. It did on Philo, who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, but on the rabbis who lived in Israel or Babylonia, didn't seem to have an influence, weirdly enough. Yeah.
Word-wise, could the word for robe be similar to the word for shroud? If you're buried in a shroud?
The word for Rome?
Robe.
Robe. Oh. Could
he appear
in the robe? Is there a thing more old? Me'il. Is not tachrichim or shrouds, and this is me'il. So It doesn't sound like it, but I don't know if me'il could have been used in biblical Hebrew. I have to take a look, because I don't know. Yeah.
In the beginning of today's session, David is going hat in hand to a feast.
Right.
And by the end of that chapter, he's second in command, somewhat akin to the Joseph story.
It is. There are parallels with David and Jacob and David and Joseph. He's the personal bodyguard. I don't know if that makes him second in command or not, but the whole feel of it, even though it's true that there's clearly an ascension, but David comes very differently. He comes with a force and he raids and he, you know, the thing that's similar, although there are more similarities with David and Jacob, but the thing that seems similar about David and Joseph is the power of their personal charisma. That's what's similar. But you've got to figure, I mean, even though that's true, you've also got to figure that that's going to be true about most heroic biographies that you read. It's very rare that you read a biography of a heroic figure and they say, but by the way, he didn't have any charisma at all. You know, nobody was particularly drawn to him. He was just successful in X, Y, or Z, which can be true if somebody's gifted with a technical skill. Like, you know, I don't know, if somebody is a great mathematician or somebody is, you know, somebody is gifted in music, that might be true. But if it's in politics or power or so on, it's almost certain that they're going to have charisma.
I don't remember, but when Moses passes, does he go up?
It doesn't say.
It doesn't say. Pass away and if he go up, he would want to come down.
Right. Well, he's on the mountain, and it says he dies, and God gives him a kiss of death. I mean, that's according to the rabbis. And God attends to his burial, but it doesn't say where his soul goes, up or down. So, which, yeah, I just want to say before it's amazing how we can't work without spatial metaphors. Because if the soul is completely insubstantial, then the truth is it neither exists anywhere nor goes anywhere. But we can't imagine that, so we use metaphors of space. I think it was Art Green that I first heard this comment from, that Judaism in general, and I think it's true of religious life, but certainly Judaism, uses metaphors of height as well as metaphors of depth. By that he says, you know, the Torah says lo bashamayim, it's not in the heavens, but also it talks about what's in your heart. So there's God isn't somehow in the sky, is the sky God, but God is also somehow inside you. And those two metaphors, which don't, you know, which are very different, both of them, our religious life is full of them. But the metaphor of going down, I told you that a couple of weeks ago that I heard that guy interviewed who does forensic, he unearths graves and does forensic testing because they interviewed him about the fact that they're going to unearth Arafat. Never heard anything about that, by the way. And he said that the first unburial that he ever did, excavation of a tomb that he ever did, was Jesse James, and he was buried face down. Yeah. And when he found out, he said that's because, yeah, they wanted him to see where he was going. So that was really the theory, yeah.
Was it a common practice to call up ghosts before Saul's victory?
Don't know. Apparently it was common enough that Saul had to outlaw it. And you don't make a law against something that's not happening. So, and this woman must have been well known. Before God used to apparently speak to Saul before, when he would ask him, but not now. Yeah.
For some reason, when you talk about this, I see the movie Ghost.
The movie Ghost, right? Yeah. Where he ascends.
Yeah.
Yes, he ascends at the end. Right.
Whoopi
yeah.
Goldberg sitting.
Right.
And coming, and it could be that when this woman saw Samuel, Samuel told her, "This is Saul, who's sitting in front of you."
Well, if you assume that Samuel in fact came up, then yes. If she was serving as the medium, like in the movie Ghost, if she was actually serving as the medium for a real person who came up from the dead, sure, Samuel could have said, by the way, that's Saul who just called me up, FYI. although Samuel didn't use abbreviations that often, but emoticons more. But he could have done that. But that's the way that mediums work, is you don't actually see a figure in front of you by and large, rather someone, and this, you know, this was an obsession, for example, of Houdini. I don't know if you know this. Houdini spent his whole life trying to find a medium who was genuine and uncovering fake, what's the plural of mediums? It can't be media. Uncovering fake media. And that's the reason that he did it, and that the Amazing Randy, by the way, does it now, who is also a magician, is that their claim is that people who tell fortunes are just skilled magicians, and they can do exactly. The Amazing Randy has a $100,000 standing bet now for 20 years that anyone can either do a psychic trick under conditions that he creates, or do a trick that he can't duplicate. And so far, nobody, no psychic, no Uri Geller, nobody else has been able to win that bet.
Is there anywhere specific that it mentioned that God
It doesn't say God is within you. No, it says you're created in God's image, though. That's as close as it gets, right? That you're B'Tselem Elohim. Yeah. No, Ten Commandments, it doesn't forbid you to kill, it forbids you to murder. Not the same. Yep. Doesn't say don't kill. There's a good word for killing in Hebrew, but tirtzach is murder. It must have been. I'm assuming that it was common knowledge. Because look, if Saul didn't kill Agag and Samuel did, you got to assume that there were people around who saw it. And that's not the kind of thing that you can keep secret. So all of Israel, I mean, it doesn't take that long probably for rumors to spread through.
I'm trying to see that there's a woman.
Right. I'm saying she could have known all of this. She could have known all of this. Look, if the Torah really said don't kill, then all these wars obviously would be illegitimate, but it doesn't. And I don't think that you could have a society where there was an absolute prohibition on killing. Otherwise, that society would be overrun in a second, you know, with human beings being what they are. Okay, now, we haven't gotten, I think we ought to at least figure out what David's going to do with the Philistines. The Philistines mustered all their forces at Aphek, while Israel was encamping in the spring in Jezreel. The Philistine lords came marching, each with his unit of hundreds and of thousands, and David and his men came marching last with Achish. The Philistine officers asked, "Who are those Hebrews?" "Why, that's David, servant of King Saul of Israel," Achish answered the Philistine officers, which is kind of a strange way of identifying him, right? But then he says, "He's been with me for a year or more, and I found no fault with him from the day he defected until now." But the Philistine officers were angry with him. He said, "What an idiot." And the Philistine officer said to him, "Send the man back. Let him go back to the place you assigned him. He shall not march down with us to battle, or else he may become our adversary in battle." Now, by the way, there, the Hebrew word for adversary, anybody want to guess? Satan. Very good. You get 5 points. Satan. The word Satan, which later became mythological, opposing angel, devil, just really in its origin means adversary or opponent. It's not supernatural. It says, lest he become our Satan b'milchama, our adversary in battle. Okay, so it's also interesting that you can see how different ideas explode in different ways. For with what could that fellow appease his master if not with the heads of these men? You just said he was Saul's servant. So the only way he's going to make Saul happy is by killing us. Remember, he is David, of whom they sang as they danced. Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. Now, another interesting thing here is that the Philistines know about this. You can feel, and this you actually get a much better sense when you're in Israel than you do here, of how close adversarial people can be. America has gives you a very distorted sense of that, because we don't think that, you know, the adversaries could be on the next block. But that's, I mean, we're talking about really close, constant contact between enemy peoples. And so if some rumor is flying through the Israelite ranks, of course the Philistines are going to know about it. They're the Philistines. They have constant contact with the Israelites. For all we know, there was trade at the same time that there was fighting, which is not uncommon among enemies. And that's one of the reasons why even in America, relationships between American Indians and white settlers was complicated. You know, sometimes there was war and sometimes there was peace, and there were lots of different things happening at once, as will happen with human beings in close proximity. Do you know the phrase familiarity breeds contempt? Mm-hmm. So Mark Twain said familiarity breeds contempt and children. It's like, you know, the opposite. The two, and both are true. So Achish summoned David and said to him, as the Lord lives, you're an honest man. truer words were often spoken. And I would like to have you serve in my forces, for I found no fault with you from the day you joined me until now. But you're not acceptable to the other lords. So go back in peace and do nothing to displease the Philistine lords. David, however, said to Achish, but what have I done? What fault have you found in your servant from the day I appeared before you to this day, that I shouldn't go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? Achish replied to David, I know you are as acceptable to me as an angel of God, but the Philistine officers have decided that you must not march out with us to battle. So rise early in the morning, you and your lord's servants who came with you, rise early in the morning, and again, why that repetition is there is not clear, but we'll talk about it, and leave as soon as it is light. Accordingly, David and his men rose early in the morning to leave, to return to the land of the Philistines, while the Philistines marched up to Jezreel. In other words, they went back to Philistine land, right? They didn't go to Israel. They went back to Philistine land, and that's where Achish told them to stay while they go to battle. Now, the first thing that strikes you if you're reading this story without any preconceptions about David is it's incredibly convenient that he was not placed in a position where he either had to fight with the Philistines or against them. Because either one would have put him in a completely untenable position. Had he fought with the Philistines, would the Israelites ever accept him as the king of Israel? And had he fought against the Philistines, he wouldn't live, because the Philistines are about to win. So what's really going on here? Again, if you take the religious view, then what happened is that God is protecting him and providing and influencing Achish and Achish's lords, because you need the combination of both. If Achish's lords have their way, they would just kill him, right? Because what do you need an Israelite general for? Better to be done with him. But Achish, the king, clearly protects him, so you can't just kill him. On the other hand, if Achish had his way, David would be fighting in battle with the Philistines against the Israelites, and that would be the end of David too. So the only possible delicate balance is Achish likes him, the Philistine lords don't, so he gets sent out of the battle and has to sit on the sidelines. And lo and behold, that's what happens. I don't know how to read this. If you're reading it against the text, it's very hard to figure. I think that it's got to be clear that David doesn't fight with the Israelites. That's got to be clear, because the Israelites are about to get defeated. And Saul and Saul's son are about to get killed, just as the witch of Endor said they would. But on the other hand, I have to say it's difficult to believe that David could have fought with the Philistines in any way and then later been successful in establishing himself as king of Israel, unless he succeeded in fighting those people who were supporters of Saul, and people interpreted this as part of his push towards the kingship. But even that is a tricky guess. So I don't know what to make exactly of what happened in this battle, but as you'll see next time when we go through the battle, David has his own, stuff goes on with David while the battle is raging, but then of course what happens is that the Philistines attack and Saul is conveniently wiped out. I say conveniently because remember David again and again and again can't kill Saul, but Saul has to die in order for David to become king. And the only vehicle by which Saul can die is the enemies of Israel, because if anybody in Israel kills Saul, then David's automatically suspect. Because they're acting for David. So, okay, questions, comments on, yeah. Possible. I mean, I don't look. There are scenarios we can construct. It's hard to know, but yeah. however he manages it, things break David's way. And how much of it is luck and how much of it is God and how much of it is plotting, it's hard to know. Remember that David has other Israelites with him. So it could be even that there are people in Israel, there may be sources of information back and forth, who know what David's doing and support him in this, although it's still very hard to figure out how he managed to get out of the battle, because you would think that that would be the ultimate proof for the Amalekites, that he was on their side. So, other, yeah?
Sending David out of the battle is something akin to why Israeli Arabs are not required to serve in the army.
Exactly so, right. Because you feel like, he said it's akin to why Israeli Arabs are not required to serve in the army, because you feel like they won't fight on your side, or at least you're putting them in a position of tremendous conflict. Yes. So, and the other part of this is that in the end, if you believe that God has any hand in history, you still want to read the text against the text, you could just say that, look, it's true that people want to make David perfect, or certainly better than he was, but part of the lesson of this is that, you know, as Rabbi Alexandri says very beautifully in the Midrash, he says, people, when they put out broken vessels, are embarrassed. In other words, you don't put out broken plates when you have guests for dinner. Maybe you do, but at least Rabbi Alexandri thought if you did, you would be embarrassed. He says, but God only has interest in broken vessels. Yes? I don't know. I have to look that up. Yeah.
Why does it say three times early one?
Right. So there are two possibilities. I mean, there are more than two possibilities, but they talk about the fact that different manuscripts have different readings if you look down at the note. But there is a list I mentioned before, and I don't begin to remember most of it. Of scribal errors. That is, when people copy something over, because the human brain is the human brain, they make certain kinds of errors over and over and over again. And if you look through ancient manuscripts, you'll find, and one of them is called haplography, that is, you write the same thing twice, which makes perfect sense, because if you think about it, so your time, remember the conditions under which most of these things were copied, right? It was late, they only had fire to go by. These were not people who, you know, who were generally in the best of health. And as they got older and they were writing, and so you could easily imagine that you wrote a line and then you fell asleep or you forgot or you were distracted or whatever, and you looked back at the manuscript and you wrote the same line again. And so most lines like that, according to modern scholars, it's just a scribal mistake, but scribal mistakes in a religious tradition get repeated over and over and over again, because in sacred scripture nothing is a mistake. And in some ways it's remarkable that the manuscripts are as close as they are. It attests to the great care with which copyists repeated them, but as we know, there are no two manuscripts of the Torah from the 10th century on, which is the only time we have manuscripts, that are identical. They all have little differences, and a couple of them have bigger differences, and also even the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that's why when they talk about the Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Torah that survives from, you know, before the rabbinic age. So that's a very ancient translation. That's how we know that Jews spoke Greek, and yet it doesn't seem to have influenced the culture very much until later. So anyway, so people have a tendency towards repetition, and especially if they forget, and so they write it again. Okay? Yes.
Speaking of manuscripts, my daughter is learning this year how to read Rashi.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that Hebrew letter so different?
Only for, the only reason that the letters of Rashi are different is it was a decision of the printer to set it off from the other text. It had nothing to do with Rashi, it had to do with the printer. He put it in what's, he invented something called Rashi script so that you could read it and it would be clear that it wouldn't bleed into the text because, again, we don't know how many marginal notes ended up inside the text. Because if they were handwritten and the text was handwritten, if the writing was similar, someone might think that this belongs inside the text, which is another one of those scribal errors. So when they started to print Rashi, who is the classical biblical commentator next to the text, they made the print of Rashi different so that it would be set off from the main text. Okay.